Okay, we're ready to begin. And what I'd like to do first, as you know and can tell, we're approaching in our study of John the death of Messiah. So I'd like to take just a few brief minutes to answer a question that is sometimes on the mind of believers or non-believers, and it's an important question. It has a short, somewhat simple answer, but it's a profound answer. Now, here's the question. Why did Yeshua have to die? And so I'd like to approach that question and answer it so that we can give an intelligent response to those. You know, if you're witnessing to someone and you're telling them about how Yeshua died, they may say to you, why did he have to die? They may come up with other alternatives than the death of God's Son that could have solved the solution. I've heard that. Here's why Yeshua had to die. Yeshua had to die primarily because of two aspects of the character of God. Two aspects of the character of God. The first is God's justice. Scripture teaches us that God is a just God. And because he is a just God, he cannot, for example, say to us, well, I forgive you your sin, and just by that word, have it dealt with. Because that would not serve his sense of justice. His sense of justice demands that sin result in a penalty. The second aspect of God's character, and we're going to put these together so we see, get the total picture, which made necessary the death of Yeshua, is God's love. God's justice requires that sin result in a penalty. And of course, as we know, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So we're deserving of that penalty. But God's love gave us a way of escape. And what God did was he served his justice. Sin did result in a penalty for sin, but his love, I don't want to say caused him, but his love resulted in his having his son die in our place. And the penalty for sin was paid with the death of his son. Now, the scriptures are clear that all have sinned. And let me just give you some verses here. Ezekiel 18:14, that's from the Old Covenant. See, if we're using this if we're sharing the gospel with someone, we want to back all of these things up. I just pretty much gave you the summary. But Ezekiel chapter 18 and 14 I think that's the wrong verse that I wrote down. Let me check. Yeah, Ezekiel 18:14. Well, it's actually Ezekiel 18, and it's towards the end of the chapter. And it's not exactly the verse that I was looking for. But let me just make sure. Well, Ezekiel 20 says this: the person who sins will die. And notice what it says. Yes, Ezekiel 20. The son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. And so there from the Old Testament, we have the principle that sin results in death. And Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes did say, there is not a righteous man upon the earth who always does good and never sins. 1 Kings 12:3. And I'm trying to take these passages from the Old Covenant. But 1 Kings 12:3. No, that's not correct either. I'm going to have to check on those verses because I'm not satisfied with the verses I have here. I think I know where it is. Give me 1 second. No, I'll have to check on those verses. One other verse I would like to give you from Isaiah, though, is the arm of the Lord is not so short that it cannot save, nor is his ear so heavy that it cannot hear, but your sins have made a separation between you and your God. I'm just giving you those verses, and again, there's some other ones, but I wrote down the wrong references that illustrate from the Old Covenant that all have sinned and that sin results in death. So that just shows the need for redemption. Now, another thing that the Bible teaches us is that one person cannot die for another. I can't die for your sins because I can't die for my sins. Look at it this way. The debt that I owe God because of my sins is an infinite debt because he is infinitely pure, right? And I'm finite. So I can't pay, even my own life is not sufficient to pay for my sins, let alone the sins of another. And so, essentially, that's one of the reasons, and I'm speaking theologically now, why hell is forever. Because even forever is not long enough to pay the debt. You follow that? So, on the other hand, Yeshua, who is the spotless Lamb of God and of infinite value, qualifies to pay that debt. And so basically speaking, the reason Yeshua had to die was because God's justice must be served and God's love was also served in the death of his son. And that's why Paul is able to say, he made him to be sin. This is 2 Corinthians 5:21. He made him to be sin who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. That's called the great exchange. Yeshua became sin on our behalf, and his righteousness was charged to our account. See, think of it this way. In order for us to get to heaven, we need two things: righteousness and cleansing from sin. Cleansed from sin because of his death, and we're righteous because we are now in Messiah, so we participate in his righteousness. See it? Okay. And again, I'm sorry, those verses, I put down the wrong. Romans 6:23 is the New Covenant verse. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But the verses that I had from Kings and Ezekiel, I must have put down the wrong references, and I'll correct them and bring you the right ones next time. Okay. But any basic questions on, if somebody would say to you, well, why did Yeshua have to die? Basically, we can answer that. He had to die because we've sinned. Because of our sin, we die. If that's why we die physically. We are spiritually dead. If we die separated from God by our sin, we will separate it from for eternity. God can't just say, okay, I'll just forget about that. Because of his justice, sin must be penalized. But because of God's love, he sent his son to take the penalty for us. And therefore, we are cleansed of our sin. Our sin is taken off of us and placed on him on the cross. His justice is accounted to us, and a redemption is accomplished. Everybody basically follow the line of reasoning there? Okay. Okay, let's go back now to where we were in the narrative. And we're in chapter 18 now. We have finished with what we generally call the upper room discourse, that lengthy discourse by Yeshua whereby he prepares his disciples for his soon departure. And they leave the upper room. Now again, remember, we're not sure if they left the upper room, if they stayed in the upper room for the entire discourse, or left the upper room during the discourse, and he continued teaching on the way to the garden. The reason it's possible he left is, remember, he starts talking about the vine, and when undoubtedly on their way to the garden, they were passing by vines. So there's a possibility, and he always used things in the surrounding, things in nature, things they were familiar with. But be that as it may, so we're on in chapter 18, and we've covered through the first 27 verses. And we should be on page 154 in our notes. 154 in our notes. And let me just read so we can pick up the flow of the narrative. Let me just quickly read starting from verse 19. The high priest then questioned Yeshua about his disciples and about his teaching. Yeshua answered him, I have spoken openly in the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. Okay? Now, there's a comment that I want to make about that I didn't make last time. And it's an objection that I've heard from non-believers, especially non-believing Jews who are somewhat familiar with the Old Testament, and that's this. Isaiah 53:7. You know Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, says, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, he opened not his mouth. And so I've heard the objection, he did open his mouth. But you've got to take that in the context of what is happening. And the best way for me to illustrate what was taking place there is this. Imagine somebody is brought in for questioning by, you know, the police, and a detective takes him in that little room to question him and so forth. And they have a conversation, and what is your name? He tells him his name. Where do you live? He tells him where you live. And he asks him some questions, but he won't respond in his own defense when asked questions about the crime. So the detective walks out, and the other detectives say to him, well, what happened? He said, I couldn't get him to talk. See? That's the point. Yeshua did not offer up a defense. So that's what it's saying there. Okay, let's continue on. So Yeshua says, why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Yeshua, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? Yeshua answered him, if I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me? So Annas set him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. And we've read that before. And then we have the denials. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, so they said to him, you are not also one of his disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I am not. One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, notice this attests to the eyewitness nature of this account, the details, said, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. Okay, so that's how far we got last time. And there's something I'd like to give you. Remember last time we mentioned that these trials were illegal? Here I have a little handout that you can go through. And these are the laws of the Sanhedrin regarding trials. And as you go through this and compare this to the trials of Yeshua, you will see most of these laws were broken. The trials of Yeshua were illegal trials. So I thought you could have that, and you can put it into your notebook right around John 18. But just looking at this, for example, one, there was to be no arrest by religious authorities that was affected by a bribe. Well, Judas, there was a bribe involved, right? Okay, there were to be no steps of criminal proceedings after sunset. The trial took place when? After sunset. Okay, judges or Sanhedrin members are not allowed to participate in the arrest. They did. So you could go through that, and one thing that really, you know, is bothersome is number 21. A person condemned to death was not to be scourged or beaten beforehand. They beat him before he was even tried. And again, to me, this really expresses the irrationality and greed and self-serving attitude of the Pharisees, because here they are accusing Yeshua of healing on the Sabbath, breaking the Sabbath, but look what they're doing. Look what they're doing. And that's when Yeshua said to them, you're whitewashed tombs. Inside, you're full of dead men's bones. Okay. So now continuing on, and we'll begin in verse 28. We're going to read about Yeshua before Pilate. And this will take us from 28 through the rest of the chapter. So that's what we'll be concentrating on right now. John 18, 28 through the rest of the chapter, the trial before Pilate. Then they led Yeshua from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. When it says it was early, it was probably pre-dawn by this time. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Again, the utter hypocrisy of what's happening here. They don't want to enter the praetorium because they might be defiled, but they're breaking about 20 different laws at the same time, right? Okay. Therefore, Pilate went out and said to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Now, Pilate was the governor, and they bring this man before Pilate, and he asks the proper and reasonable question. What is the accusation? They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." You notice how they're kind of like wavering a little bit because they have no accusation. So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." In other words, bear in mind something. When Pilate said to them, "What is the accusation?" he was looking for them to respond that Yeshua broke a Roman law, right? And even their own accusation against Yeshua, blasphemy, had nothing to do with it. Rome could have cared less about that. So when they didn't have a response to Pilate about he broke this law or that Roman law, Pilate figured they got some kind of religious problem with this guy. He said, "Judge him yourselves. This has nothing to do with me." So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death," which they were not. Remember what we said. Romans, the way the Romans would administer their kingdom was they would allow local rule. And for example, the Sanhedrin was local rule in civil matters and minor criminal matters, but they could not pronounce or carry out capital punishment. Only the Roman authorities could do that. But notice what they said, "We're not allowed to put anyone to death." So right away, one of the things they're kind of saying to Pilate is, this is a serious thing, this is a capital crime. Okay? But in saying that, notice what it says, "We're not permitted to put anyone to death to fulfill the words of Yeshua which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die." Now what does that mean? If the Jewish leaders had decided to break yet one more law and put him to death, how would they have done it? Stoning. But according to Yeshua himself and the Old Testament prophecies, Psalm 22, how is he to die? According to the prophecies, crucifixion. Remember when Yeshua said, when the Son of Man is lifted up, you know, and remember Psalm 22 describes. So right away we see in the midst of this irrational tumult that's going on, God is in control. God is in control. Okay. Therefore, Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Yeshua and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, that question was an important one because bear in mind, so far as Pilate is concerned, he's not concerned about blasphemy. He's concerned about insurrection, right? So the question, "Are you the king of the Jews?" is a question that's kind of is saying, are you the leader of this Jewish people and are going to lead a rebellion? Have they appointed you their king and you're going to... So that's the nature of that question. Okay? Yeshua answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Pilate really still doesn't even have an accusation. He's fishing for something. Essentially, he sees no guilt in this man, and he's trying to decide, why is this man standing before me? Yeshua answered, and this is a very important answer, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Now, the significance of that answer is Pilate now says to himself, there's no threat here. He understands. I mean, he doesn't understand the full implications, of course, of the kingdom of God. But he can see in what Yeshua is saying, my kingdom is not of this world. If it were, then my people would be fighting. Pilate's response is, this man is not a rebel. He's not going to lead an insurrection. This is some religious thing that doesn't really concern me. So he answers. Therefore, Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" So now he's curious. Yeshua answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Now, Pilate gives what to me is a very, very interesting response, which can be taken two ways. He says, Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" In all likelihood, he was being sarcastic. Who knows, though? Maybe he was saying, "What is the truth?" But it seems as though he was being sarcastic here. But the irony is, here's a man, Pilate, asking the question, "What is truth?" of the person who is the truth. So there's an irony there. And when he had heard this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." Pilate could not find any reason according to Roman law. And remember, if Pilate wasn't concerned about the Mosaic law in this particular instance, that, as far as he was concerned, that's a Jewish matter. There was absolutely no evidence that Yeshua had broken Roman law. He says, I find no fault in this man. And then it goes on, verse 39, "But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the King of the Jews?" So, Pilate's trying to get it away. Pilate's uncomfortable right now. He's trying to get out of this. He's nervous about this. He's nervous about the fact that they came in the nighttime, and not just the soldiers, the Sanhedrin was there, and they're demanding he be put to death. And Pilate wants to defuse this whole thing. So he tries to find a way out, and they did have a custom in those days that on the Passover, the Romans would release someone. So they cried out, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now, Barabbas was a robber. He was more than a robber. I believe we'll see. He was a robber, he was a murderer, and he was an insurrectionist. So here they would rather have this Barabbas released than the source of life. Okay? And you can see here, remember that tension that we talked about, light, darkness, belief, unbelief? You can see unbelief is climaxing here. These men who have arrested Yeshua and taken him before Pilate, their unbelief, in a sense, has polluted their minds. You see it? They're not really even thinking rationally anymore. Okay, let's go to the notes now. Yeshua before Pilate. John does not describe the early morning session of the council when Yeshua was brought before the council. There, Caiaphas put Yeshua on oath to declare whether or not he was the Son of God. And on his assertion that he was, Yeshua was condemned on a charge of blasphemy. Now, that's in Mark 14, 60-64. So we do somewhat of a harmony of the Gospels to get the full account. But in Mark 14... and verses 60-64, it says, "The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Yeshua, saying, 'Do you not have an answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?' But he kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' And Yeshua said, 'I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, 'What further do we need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy,' and they condemned him to be deserving of death." And notice here, they break the law. They spit at him, they blindfolded him, and they beat him before he was tried and convicted. Okay? So the Sanhedrin condemns him to death. The problem is they can't carry it out. So they have to take him to Pilate and try to manipulate Pilate into executing him. Okay, but because the high priest had no authority to carry out a death sentence, it was necessary to transfer the trial to the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. Thus, after the verdict of the Jewish council, the trial was moved to Pilate's residence. Okay, number two. Since the Jewish council did not have the right to put Yeshua to death, the case had to be put before the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. Normally, the governor lived in Caesarea, but during the great feasts, it was prudent for him to come to Jerusalem in case of a riot or insurrection took place. So he was there, you know, the Passover and those feasts that all the Jewish people came to Jerusalem, there was a heightened sense of national pride. And so there was always that danger, and a large group of people, there was always that danger, someone's going to get up who's a charismatic figure and lead a revolt. So it was prudent for Pilate to be there just to make sure the peace was kept. So that's why he was in Jerusalem at that time. Passover was particularly dangerous because emotions ran high since the Jews remembered their deliverance from bondage. And so since the Jews remembered deliverance from bondage in Egypt, during the Passover time, they might say, well, now is the time for us to be delivered from the bondage of Rome. Okay? Okay, next page, three. The Jews would not enter a Gentile house, in this case, the governor's palace, but they could go into the courtyard under the colonnades. That's where they went. Into a, you know, picture, Pilate's house was somewhat like a palace, but not as big as you picture a palace. But it was a grand house, and it had a yard, more than a yard, a courtyard. And it was walled and enclosed, and that's where they held the trial, in that courtyard. It is ironic that the Jewish leaders were concerned with ritual uncleanness while they planned murder. So Pilate came out to the courtyard and began an informal inquiry. So this is where we are right now, what we've read. Pilate right now is in the initial stages of just trying to gather some information. That's all he's doing. He wants to essentially see whether or not there's... You know how one of the things that has to happen in our system of law is before someone's charged with a crime and be brought to court, the DA has to say, is there what they call probable cause? Is there sufficient evidence here to bring this to trial? And so that's what Pilate's doing now. He just wants to get some information. Okay, four. A Roman trial normally began with the statement, what accusation do you bring against this man? And that's what Pilate did. When the charges were revealed, any evidence for both sides was presented and a verdict rendered. So that's basically, and that's similar to ours. What is the charge? This is the charge. The accusers present your case. The accused present your case. Verdict. And that's similar to what happens in our system of law. Notice, however, Yeshua was not given an opportunity to bring witnesses. A, the Roman governor had the option to judge in the trial of a non-Roman citizen or to delegate his authority to another officer or court. When Pilate found that Yeshua had violated some Jewish law, he opted to authorize the Sanhedrin to try him and carry out the sentence under Jewish law. That's 18 and 31, where he says, so Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. This was the first of six attempts by Pilate to release Yeshua. Very interesting dynamic that's going on here, because Pilate is very uncomfortable about this, and he doesn't want to execute Yeshua when he has not broken a Roman law. But bear in mind, there's human dynamics going on. The Sanhedrin is applying pressure to him, and we're going to see how that pressure finally causes Pilate to fold. Additionally, God has determined the means by which Yeshua would die. Okay? Okay. B. The Jews declined the right to try Yeshua, claiming, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death." Now notice what, when they say that, the implication there. They're saying to Pilate, Pilate doesn't, remember when he first said to him, you know, what is the accusation? He doesn't even know yet. Before even telling Pilate the accusation, what are they saying? We can't put anyone to death. In other words, he committed a capital crime. So right away, this becomes pretty serious in Pilate's mind. But he's still confused because there's no accusation yet. Did you have a question? Okay. However, Pilate had authorized the Jews to inflict the necessary penalty for blasphemy, stoning. So he was a little wishy-washy there. He was kind of bending the law a little bit. When he gave the Jewish leaders the authority to try Yeshua against by their law, and being aware that although there was no Roman, there was no accusation of a Roman crime being broken, it was just, you know, blasphemy, which didn't concern them, he did authorize the Sanhedrin to try him according to the law, which indicates he was kind of giving them permission to stone Yeshua. He was trying to wash the blood off of his own hands. Okay? The Jews did, in fact, stone Stephen without Roman approval. So when push came to shove, you know. The real motive behind the Jews' refusal was that just as they did not want to defile themselves by entering Pilate's hall, they did not want to defile themselves by executing Yeshua. Ironically, the Jews' refusal to stone Yeshua would result in his fulfillment of the kind of death he was to die. And what does it say in the Bible? God works all things after the counsel of his own will. So we see this early pre-dawn morning illegal trial going on, and it seems as though it's all confusion, everything's being done wrong, God is in control. Next. John explained why Yeshua was delivered by the Jews to the Romans. Jewish executions were by stoning, which normally broke bones. Reasonable. The Roman method of execution was crucifixion. It was necessary for three reasons for Yeshua to be crucified by the Romans at the instigation of the Jews. Okay, let's look at them. A, to fulfill prophecies, for example, that none of his bones would be broken. Exodus 12:46, Numbers 9:12, you can just take these are the prophecies we're referring to. And Psalm 34:20. And for example, Psalm 34:20 says, "He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken." Okay? So that's one reason. B, second reason for the crucifixion, and this is significant. To include both Jews and Gentiles in the collective guilt of the deed. Listen to Acts 2:23, very significant verse. Acts 2:23, and this is during Peter's sermon. Listen to what he says. I'm going to go back to verse 22. "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Yeshua the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God," right? God in control. "You nailed to a cross." Now, who's he speaking to? The Jewish leaders. "You nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men," the Romans, "and put him to death." So one of the reasons it was necessary for Yeshua to be crucified was that it would involve the collective guilt of Jewish and Gentile people, and also the sovereign will of God. Okay? Acts 4:27 expresses the same thought. Acts 4:27. For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Yeshua, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel. So that affirms the same thing. Now, there's one more thing I want to point out. In Galatians 3:13, it says something significant. Do you remember this? In the law, it says, cursed is he who hangs on a tree. That's another reason for the crucifixion. Because being crucified was the equivalent of being hanged on a tree for those purposes. Generally speaking, when the Romans crucified someone, they left them there for a while as a warning to others. And it says in Galatians 3:13, he became a curse for us. Galatians 3:13. Let me get the exact wording of that. In Galatians 3:13, it says, Messiah redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, and here's the prophecy, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. So that's another reason for the crucifixion, that he might become a curse for us. D. Yeshua had been accused of the sin of blasphemy. Although this was of no consequence to Pilate, another charge was treason. And that's in Luke 23, 2 and 5, again doing kind of a harmony of the Gospels. Watch what happens at this turn. And bear in mind the narrative. Pilate isn't concerned about blasphemy, but in Luke 23, verse 2, they say, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Messiah, a king. So forbidding to pay taxes would break Roman law, but that's a lie, because what did Yeshua said? Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. And remember when he had Peter go get the fish so they could pay the tax? And also in verse 5 of Luke 23 it says, but they kept on insisting, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place. Okay? So you see that the Pharisees are shifting from the charge of blasphemy to a charge of insurrection. They're trying to coerce or intimidate or convince Pilate to have him crucified. This was a crime of which Tiberius, this was a crime of which Tiberius Caesar was particularly sensitive and had to be severely investigated and punished. Therefore, Pilate entered into the praetorium and called Yeshua to him to question him. So now, Pilate's saying to him, okay, now they've accused him of something and I have to get involved now. So he does the next note. So far, Pilate's doing okay so far. He goes to question Yeshua, which is a reasonable thing to do. So he goes in to question Yeshua. And it says, the phrase, are you the king of the Jews, can be translated as a question or a declaration whose force is affirmative. In other words, that could be translated, are you the king of the Jews, or you are the king of the Jews. It could be translated either way. John suggested Pilate knew that Yeshua was the king of the Jews. When he finally sent Yeshua to be crucified, his accusation read, Yeshua the Nazarene, king of the Jews. Remember that sign that they put up there? Okay. Yeshua's reply irritated Pilate, for he was used to receiving answers to his questions, not challenges. And remember when Yeshua said, how do you know this? Did somebody tell you, or did... Pilate wasn't used to that. Most people were so intimidated by Pilate, they would just answer the questions. Yeshua's reply irritated Pilate, for he was used to receiving answers to his questions, not challenges. Since he had shown sufficient interest in Yeshua to confer with him privately, Yeshua began to probe him to see how sincere his interest might be. Very interesting. Because who knows where this might have led? Yeshua might have led this down the same road he went with Nicodemus, always reaching out. But of course, Pilate's heart was cold. Okay, let's take our break now. Okay, continuing, I do have the verses that we discussed earlier from the Tanakh, the Old Testament, confirming the reality of sin, the universal nature of sin in humanity, and the penalty for sin. And first, we want to look at 1 Kings 8:46. And to give you the context here, Solomon is praying a prayer of dedication for the temple. And he says these words. I'll begin with verse 44 to pick up the flow. When your people go out to battle against their enemy, by whatever way you shall send them, and they pray to the Lord toward the city which you have chosen and the house which I have built for your name, then hear in heaven their prayer and their supplication and maintain their cause. When they sin against you, for there is no man who does not sin, and you are angry with them and deliver them to an enemy so that they take them away captive to the land of the enemy far near, if they take thought in the land where they have been taken captive and repent and make supplication to you in the land of those who have taken them captive, saying, we have sinned and we have committed iniquity, we have acted wickedly, if they return to you with all their heart and with all their soul in the land of their enemies who have taken them captive and pray towards their land which you have given to their fathers, the city which you have chosen, and the house which I have built for your name, then hear their prayer. And it goes on. But the key thing there is where Solomon says, when they sin against you, for there is no man who does not sin. So there's an Old Testament scripture affirming what we know from the New Covenant, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. What the reference? It's 1 Kings 8:46. Oh, Romans 6:23 is the New Covenant equivalent where it says all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Okay, now, Ezekiel 18:4. Ezekiel 18:4 is the other scripture that I wanted to mention. And see, these are good verses for witnessing the Jewish people, because Jewish people often don't acknowledge the existence of sin, or even if you do sin, if you balance it out with good deeds, so forth and so on. But listen to what Ezekiel 18:4 says. Behold, all souls are mine. This is God speaking. The soul of the Father as well as the soul of the Son. The soul whose sins will die. That's pretty clear. And so again, that relates to why Yeshua had to die. He had to die, as I said, the two foundational aspects we looked at were God's justice and love. God's justice had to be served. All have sinned, the soul that sins will die. But his love gave us a way of escape. And a key verse there is in 1 John where it says he is the propitiation for our sins. You're familiar with that? He is the satisfaction. The Messiah's death satisfies God's justice. Okay, so I wanted to get you the proper verses on there. Okay, now continuing with the narrative. And we still have, let's see, Yeshua's before Pilate. And where we are right now is where Pilate has just asked Yeshua Are you the king of the Jews? And Yeshua answered, are you saying this on your own initiative, or did someone tell you? And so that's where we continue. Yeshua's reply, oh, we read that. Pilate's reply was indignant. I am not a Jew, am I? In other words, what, excuse me.
We skipped what?
Well, we did F. Do you recognize it? B? Yeah, we did do F. Yeah, that's right where we ended the course. I marked it as we said it. But look through it. If you have questions, let me know, and I'll answer them. Okay, so when Yeshua said to him, when Yeshua answered Pilate by saying, you know, Pilate asked, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, are you saying this on your own initiative? Own initiative, or did others tell you? Pilate becomes somewhat perturbed, indignant. And he said, Pilate answered, I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priest delivered you to me. What have you done? Again, notice something. Pilate's fishing for some, what has he done here? There's no valid accusation here. Okay. This is G. Pilate's reply was indignant. I'm not a Jew, am I? Pilate did not want to be classified as a Jew. He insisted that he was merely trying to solve the puzzling case the Jewish leaders had brought against him. He had not originated the accusation, but wanted to know what Yeshua had done to arouse their hatred. I think that Pilate kind of knew what was going on here. And that's one of the reasons he was trying to squirm his way out of it. Okay, let's continue. Upon Pilate asking Yeshua why his own nation and chief priests had delivered Yeshua to him, verse 35, Yeshua replied that Rome need not fear a political insurrection. And that's where Yeshua says to him, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom of this world, my servants would be fighting. So essentially, with that statement, the proper response for Pilate would be to just let him go. Or hand them over to the Sanhedrin and say, try them according to your law, but you may not perform capital punishment. That would have been the correct response of Pilate at that point. But let's continue. He was not a zealot or a revolutionary. His kingdom was not like that. He was not of this world. It is from another place, that is heaven. And we see that in verse 36. My kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom is not of this realm. Therefore, it comes not by rebellion, but by submission to God. Its source was not from men's acts of violence, but from the new birth from heaven, which transferred a person out of Satan's kingdom and into God's kingdom. And there's an important principle here that we should mention. If Yeshua had chosen to, could he have led an insurrection and conquered the world? Yeah. But bear in mind something. If he had done that, he would have been the ruler of a world full of sinful people. He could have kept the peace, but it wouldn't have been paradise. And so that's why it was necessary that when Yeshua came the first time, he not actually set up his physical kingdom on earth. He first had to bring peace to the hearts of men and cleansing from their sins to prepare a people ready for himself so that when he returns, he can set up a kingdom of peace. So there's a real logic to what's happening here. Okay, continuing on. Notice Colossians 1:13 is very important here and speaks to this. For he delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son. Now, this is sometimes referred to as the mystery kingdom, because although technically the kingdom will not be set up until the millennium begins, the mystery kingdom is now in place. It's a kingdom that can't be seen with the eyes, it's seen with the heart, and we're all members of it, and we experience it. And so when it says he transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son, that's a present position that we have. We're in the kingdom of God now. We're just waiting for it to be physically manifested. Since Yeshua spoke of a kingdom, Pilate seized on the word king. So you are a king. See, now this perked up his ears. Yeshua affirmed that he was a king. In just a few words, Yeshua, notice how interesting this is, asserted his divine origin. I have come into the world. So that's his divine origin. And ministry, to testify to the truth. Pilate's question, what is truth, is problematic. Was it a desire to know what no one could tell him? Was it a philosophical cynicism? Was it indifference to anything so impractical as abstract thought? The significant thing is that he suddenly turned away from the one who is truth without waiting for an answer. And we see that because it says, Pilate said to him, what is truth? And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews. He didn't even wait for an answer. Now, there's something interesting here when Pilate said, what is truth? And it's just a little illustration I want to give you of the darkness into which men can fall. Here, Pilate, I mean, what better opportunity is there to know the truth than to be standing in the presence of the Son of God? But because of Pilate's unbelief, he asked the question, more than likely cynically, and turned away without even waiting for an answer. And I'd like to parallel that with a modern day event that took place. Has anybody heard of the philosopher and mathematician Bertrand Russell? Bertrand Russell was a brilliant philosopher and mathematician, a devout atheist. And he was once asked, when you die, if you then find yourself standing in the presence of God, whom you've denied all your life, what will you say to him? And Bertrand Russell's response was, I will say to him, God, why did you take such pains to hide yourself? Here's a man who is brilliant, well-known philosopher, mathematician, and he doesn't see the glory of God being manifested in creation. Regardless of how intelligent we are, regardless of how brilliant we are, if the Holy Spirit doesn't convict us of sin, righteousness, and judgment, it doesn't avail us at all. And when Bertrand Russell stands before God, he won't ask that question because he'll know. He'll realize it was before him all the time. Anyway, continuing on. Pilate once again went out to the Jews and declared, I find no guilt in him. However, he displayed a lack of commitment to justice. Having found no guilt in Yeshua, and this is what we mentioned, he should have immediately set him free. That's what he should have done. Instead, he began a series of compromising moves to avoid dealing with an inconvenient truth in a difficult circumstances. By the way, remember Pilate, one of the fears Pilate had was that the Jewish people would complain to Rome. And Rome didn't like that. Rome didn't want to be bothered. And I think this had happened before. I think that Pilate had some complaints lodged against them before. I'd have to check that. But Pilate didn't want a situation where Rome heard there's trouble in Judea and where Rome responds, well, isn't Pilate taking care of things? So he wants to diffuse this in the best way possible. even if it involves stretching the law in order to do it. Okay, first, when Pilate found out that Yeshua was from Galilee, he sent him to Herod. And that's in Luke 23, 6 and 7. So just take a brief look at that so we can get the harmony of the gospel. In Luke 23, 6 and 7, it says this. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he heard that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at this time. So Pilate, his next ploy, in a sense, was, this isn't under my jurisdiction. I'm going to send them off to Herod, which was the legal thing to do, but it was also another attempt of his to squirm out of his response, because he should have just declared him innocent. But now Yeshua is off for another trial in front of Herod. Okay. Excuse me? Right. Good point. Okay, A, first, send him to Herod. Second, Pilate tried to appeal to the crowd, hoping to bypass the desires of the chief priests and elders. Knowing that Yeshua was popular, he thought that according to custom, they might choose to have Yeshua released. See, in 1838, where it says, no, I don't think it's 1838. Let me see. Yeah, John. 39, my mistake. But you have a custom that I release someone for you at the Passover. Do you wish then that I release for you the King of the Jews? So here's another attempt of his to defuse this. But of course, bear in mind that it wasn't a crowd in the sense of like the feeding of the 5,000 by any means. It was a small group of people. Of course, you know, this was maybe like 5 o'clock in the morning. Most people were asleep. Okay. But the leaders proved to be persuasive, and the crowd called for the release of Barabbas, who was a robber. Pilate's release of Barabbas showed poor judgment for a person responsible for Rome's interests. Bear in mind what Pilate was doing here. Pilate, I believe, Barabbas was an insurrectionist. So by releasing him, he's going against Rome's interest. But it's self-preservation is his primary motive. Yes?
That's just another picture of God choosing sin over God. Man does and chooses sin over God.
Right. Good observation. Absolutely. Okay, any questions, comments? Everybody okay? Okay, now we're going to begin chapter 19. And we will begin with the scourging of Yeshua. And I want to see how far we should take this. Let's go. I want to take this a little piece at a time. That's too far. Okay, that's good. Okay, let's just take verses 1 through 7 and follow this through, because there's a lot that's going to be happening here now. This is all intensifying, and I want us to bear in mind as we're doing this, you know when it says in the Bible, our battle is not against flesh and blood? Well, that's of course true here as well, and so this battle between light and darkness and belief and unbelief, it's climaxing now. And we can see this in the narrative. We can see what's happening. We can see the unbelief of the Jewish leaders has reached a point where they have, in a sense, almost become irrational in what they're doing. They're breaking laws left and right. They're doing anything to get rid of this man. And bear in mind at the heart of this is the fact that man is murdering God. And we're all responsible. So now we go to chapter 19. So I just want to read the first seven verses first. Pilate then took Yeshua and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and put a purple robe on him. And they began to come up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and give him slaps in the face. Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." Again, Pilate does not want to go through with this. At some level, he knows it's wrong. He's trying to find a way out, but they're not giving him a way out. Yeshua then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." So when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify, crucify." That's the height of unbelief. They're in a frenzy now. Pilate said to them, "Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." Now there's the accusation, blasphemy. Now it's out. Okay? Now before we go to the notes, there's a few things that I want to go through here, and we're going to see them again in the notes, but I want to describe them vividly. You see where it says Pilate then took Yeshua and scourged him? We have to understand what scourging involved. Has anybody ever seen the movie The Passion of the Christ? And remember when he was scourged? Well, as hard as it may be to believe, it was actually worse. When they would scourge you, one of the things they would do is they would take a cat of nine tails, you know what that is? But at the end of each tail was either a sharp rock or a sharp piece of metal. And they would flog you on the back literally until bones showed through. When they put the crown of thorn on Yeshua's head, they didn't just place it there, they pushed it down so the thorns, these large thorns, dug into his scalp and blood was just coming down from his face. They pulled his beard out. Says that in the Old Testament. They plucked out his beard. Many people who were condemned to crucifixion did not survive the scourging. It was horrific. And in the midst of all that, they're beating him and mocking him. By the time they're finished scourging him, he may not be recognizable to his own mother. That's how bad he was. And yeah, go ahead.
Pilate really didn't have a reason to scourge Jesus at that time. So did he do it because he thought that would satisfy the Jews?
He did it because the Jewish people coerced him into doing it. They pressured him. He had no legal basis for doing it.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that they told him to scourge him, but that was part of
it. Well, that's part of the crucifixion process. When they said crucify, crucify, that was simply part of the process. When anybody was ever crucified, they were scourged first. Okay, so the Jewish people didn't actually have to request a scourging. It went along with crucifixion. Okay. So notice again what it says. I just want to deal with the text a little bit to get a picture of what's happening. Then we'll go to the notes. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns, put on his head. And again, they pushed that into his skull so that the blood was flowing down. They pulled his beard off. That's in the Old Testament. They began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and give him slaps in the face. And then you see where it says, Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I bring him out to you so I find no guilt in him." And look what it says. Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man. Behold the man." And the significance there is Yeshua looked so beaten by this time that Pilate hoped that the Jewish people would see him and say, "Okay, it's enough. Behold the man." And as a matter of fact, in Isaiah 52, and verse 14, and you know Isaiah 53 is the song of the suffering servant, but the song actually begins in Isaiah 52:13. But listen what it says. "Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man and his form more than the sons of man." So that's prophecy regarding what Yeshua would go through. Behold the man. Okay? And listen to what it says here. This is the other verse I referred to. "I gave my back to those who strike me." This is in Isaiah 50, verse 6. "I gave my back to those who strike me and my cheeks to those who pluck out the beard. I did not cover my face from humiliation and spitting." So just the scourging itself was horrific. I can't imagine what it does to a person. I mean, if you have a stray hair, and I know that women do this with their eyebrows, and you pluck a little hair, that's it. But to grab someone's hair like that and pull it out. So that's when, again, Pilate says, "Behold the man. Look at this. Is this enough?" Okay. But then again in verse 6, the chief priests and the officers saw him and cried out, "Crucify, crucify." They're mad now. They're in a frenzy. Pilate said to them, "Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answer him, and then they said, "We have a law." And here, look at the Jewish people now. "We have a law." They've just broken about 20 laws, right? "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." Okay, let's take that from that section from the notes. So we're on page 158 in the notes. The scourging of Yeshua. Scourging was the usual accompaniment of Roman crucifixion. So that answers your question. When somebody was crucified, first they were scourged. It wasn't like some additional penalty. It was part of the process. Roman flogging was done with a leather whip with bits of metal or bones at the end. Such flogging often killed the person. Actually, the flogging was another attempt by Pilate at compromise. He hoped that the crowd would be satisfied with a little blood. His hope was, "I'll scourge him, bring him back out." They go, "Okay, it's enough." He's still trying to squirm his way out of this, although he's already gone beyond what the law would dictate, hasn't he? He should have let him go. B, the ridiculing and blows to the face that Yeshua received were all a part of his deep humiliation as he identified with human sin. The thorns on his head are mindful of the curse of thorns caused by human sins. Remember in Genesis 3:18, thorns and thistles that shall yield for you. So this crown of thorns, although it was somewhat symbolic of, you know, King of the Jews in a mocking sense, he was the thorns that resulted from sin in our environment. And we're not only talking about the thorns of the rose bush, but the fact that nature itself is now somewhat antagonistic to us. He took that upon himself. That's the symbolism of the thorns. Okay? Next. As the soldiers brought Yeshua out, and it should be the word "to," I have taught. That's the only thing wrong with spell check. If you wrong word, correct spelling, it doesn't let you know. As the soldiers brought Yeshua out to the view of the crowd, Pilate, having once more declared his innocence, said, "Behold the man." Pilate may have thought that the horrific spectacle of Yeshua's... The horrific spectacle of Yeshua, bloody and wearing a crown of thorns, would change the attitude of the Jewish leaders. If so, he was speedily disillusioned. The Jewish officials demanded Yeshua's crucifixion for no good reason that Pilate could determine. Pilate was really in a tumultuous state right now. He told them to crucify him themselves, for no charge could be brought against him. He's basically saying, there's nothing I can do. He hasn't broken any Roman law. You want to crucify him? Crucify him. You know, he just can't find a way out of this. One, the Jews, knowing that they could not crucify Yeshua, made a new approach to Pilate, claiming that by their laws Yeshua was worthy of death because he had committed blasphemy, claiming to be the Son of God. What they're saying is maybe this will convince Pilate, get rid of this guy. He's claiming to be a Son of God, and in a sense that's another insurrection accusation. If he's a Son of God, he's even above Caesar, you know, and that in itself was very threatening to the Roman Empire. I mean, imagine walking up to Caesar, who, you know, remember Caesar was considered to be God? So for Yeshua to say, "I'm the Son of God," in a certain sense, that's Roman, that's blasphemy, even as the Romans are concerned. It's more, not so much as blasphemy, it's putting your authority above that of Caesar. So that's the new tack that they're trying. Okay? Thus, they invoked the law of blasphemy. That's in Leviticus 24:16. You can look that up, the law of blasphemy, as the ground for their insistence on Yeshua's crucifixion. Blasphemy was punishable according to Mosaic law by stoning to death. Okay? Okay, that's verses 1 through 7. And let's see where we should go now. Okay. We want to go from verses 8 through 15 next. That'll be the next segment of the narrative. So let's read 8 through 15. I always get confused here. ""90 minutes is an hour and 30 minutes, right? Good, we have time. I want to make sure I cover this. Okay, so let's read now on still chapter 18. I'm sorry, 19. Starting verse 8. Therefore, when Pilate heard this statement, the statement, he being a man, made himself out to be God, he was even more afraid. And he entered into the praetorium again and said to Yeshua, "Where are you from?" But Yeshua gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, do you not speak to me? And this is going to be very important. Pay attention to this. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and have authority to crucify you? I think we all get a feeling for why that's an important statement. And we'll see as we go through it. Yeshua answered, well, here's the answer. You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Pilate had the authority to administer justice. He isn't doing the greatest job in the world, obviously, but he's doing what he's doing. But those who delivered him over to Pilate did have the greater sin. As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, if you release this man, and now here's their next tact, you are no friend of Caesar. They're threatening him now. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. So you see the next strategy that they're using. This man said he's a king. All Caesar has to hear from us is that there's a man who claimed himself to be king, and we brought him to you, and you let him go. That's their next tact. Therefore, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Yeshua out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. The judgment seat, that's where Pilate would sit to pass judgment. Now it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, behold your king. So they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? And listen to this one. The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. Can you see where unbelief can go? How far unbelief can take you? How deeply into sin it can take you? Okay, let's go to the notes. Let's see where we are. Now, we're going to do a little harmony of the Gospels again here, but we don't actually have to look this up. About the same time that this was taking place, read with me, Pilate's wife told him, do not have anything to do with that man, for I have suffered a great deal in a dream because of him. That's in Matthew. So in the midst of all of this, while Pilate's, you know, trying to figure out what should I do here, to make matters worse, his wife comes up to him with this horrible news. And you know what? In those days, they thought the dreams were very significant. Pilate's response was one of fear. As a pagan, he had heard stories of human-like gods who visited men and judged them. Perhaps the majesty of Yeshua and his claims of truth began to convict his conscience. Yeshua's refusal to answer Pilate's question, where are you from, fulfilled the words of the prophecy in Isaiah 57:3. He offered no defense up, and we've talked about that. Okay? Listen to Isaiah 53:7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, like a lamb that is led to a slaughter and like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth. And we've discussed it doesn't mean he didn't say anything, but it's like the detective who says, I couldn't get him to talk. Okay, continuing on. Disturbed by Yeshua's silence, Pilate asked, do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? 1. Although Pilate did have some authority, by the way, where does all authority originate? God. And was responsible for his decisions? God is the only one who has ultimate and full power. And we need to remember it as believers. We may one day be in a position, obviously not the same as Yeshua, but in that direction. And there will be people who have authority over us who, it appears, control our destiny. Whether we live or die, whether we go into a, what do they call it, a... when they round people up and they have them live in a
concentration
camp, whatever it is, we need to remember that the authority they have is authority given them by God. They're responsible to God for how they administer that authority, but the ultimate decision comes from God. Okay. Although Pilate did have some authority and was responsible for his decisions, God is the only one who has ultimate and full power. Pilate, Yeshua said, was under God and was responsible to him. The one who handed me over to you had the greater sin. Okay? Two. Now the question is, do we want to answer here before we get to this? Who is the one who handed him over? So let's read. Was Yeshua referring to Judas? Because Judas is the one who betrayed him. Maybe he has the greater. Or Satan? Because Satan is certainly behind this. Let me ask you a question. Can you see Satan at work in this whole scenario with the evil things that are taking place? So maybe it's Satan. Caiaphas, who was the power broker and really was the one who had the greater influence over the Sanhedrin, the priests, or the Jewish people. Pilate was certainly guilty of not proper administration of law, but Yeshua put more weight on Caiaphas as the responsible one. And go back with me to John 11 for a moment, because this relates to something in John 11 that shows Caiaphas is, I believe, the one. John 11 and 49. Let's start from 47. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." See their motive? Their motive was not, had nothing to do with the Mosaic law, had nothing to do with righteousness, had to do with power and greed. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and the whole nation not perish." So he was the spark, the seed that led to what we're looking at right now. See it? So Yeshua may have been, I'm not being dogmatic about that, but I think he may have been referring to Caiaphas. Okay. Any other questions at this point so far? Yeah.
It appears that the people who wanted to crucify him were just the Jewish leaders, at least in one of the references. So the Gentiles, weren't any Gentiles present?
Well, if we follow the narrative, it appears as though when they went to arrest Yeshua, there were the Jewish leaders, there were soldiers that, you know, the Jewish leaders had their own little band of soldiers, and there were also Roman soldiers. So you can check the narrative on that. So it would appear that there were Roman soldiers involved, but these Roman soldiers really, they were just doing their job. It didn't make really too much difference to them how this went, I don't think, the Roman soldiers. They might have wanted them to be crucified, of course, it would put an end to their having to wake up early in the morning and do this again. Who knows? But the point is, from what we've read in Acts, you remember what Peter said? And has everybody had an opportunity to read? And if you haven't, I would really strongly suggest reading it. Who Killed Yeshua? Excellent. Read it. Because what we find when we read that is certainly the Jewish leaders are responsible. Certainly the Romans were responsible. They did not carry out Roman law in a just manner, right? So they were responsible. Pilate, Herod, the Jewish people, the Gentiles, and in fact, ultimately, who killed him? I did. Because he had to go to the cross because of my sins. So, and that's pretty much, read that. Bob goes into more detail, but that little pamphlet, Who Killed Yeshua, is absolutely excellent. And one of the reasons it's excellent, it deals with that, the accusation that is also put towards Jewish people, Christ killer. It deals with that very effectively. Just to look at a little further, who killed Yeshua? The Father sent the Son to die. The Son laid down his life. So when you look at it in its totality, you can see it was part of the redemptive program of God. However, we're responsible for what we did. Okay? Any other questions? Comments? Okay, let me just...